Hey there, lovely folks. You are tuning into CITR 101.9 FM, your campus connection based here at the Point Grey campus. Remember, we are here on the ancestral, unceded, and traditional territory of the Musqueam people. And we honor that every time we hit the airwaves. It's Monday high noon, and you know what that means. It's time for our weekly news radio show, Against the Current. I'm Ankita Goyal, your new news collective lead, and I'm super stoked to be leading the news collective for the academic year 2023-24. I'm also super stoked to be a part of this journey with you all and with the incredible team here at the station. Over the last 12 days, we've been flooded with visuals of death and destruction from the Middle East, babies injured and dying, scenes of suffering, starvation and desperation. This has not only saddened our hearts, but also ignited a fire of harshness and hatred on social media and across the world. We've witnessed a rise in anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, fueled by irresponsible media coverage and opportunistic global politics. It's time for some perspective. On the 7th of October, Hamas launched an attack on Israel, resulting in the death of 1,400 people and kidnapping of 150 hostages. Israel's subsequent military response has been the worst we've seen in the history of the region. In Gaza, the death toll has risen to over 3,000, with authorities suggesting that thousands might still be trapped beneath the rubble. Heartbreakingly, more than 1,000 children have lost their lives in just 12 days. An estimated 1.1 million people from Gaza have been displaced from their homes. And the 2 million residents of Gaza are trapped in a small stretch of land deprived of basic necessities such as food, electricity and water till date. They face continuous bombings with no escape routes available. While Israel claims its actions are aimed at eradicating Hamas, who they accuse of using civilians as human shields, the intensity and the scale of their response can be seen as the acts of extreme revenge, genocide, and ethnic cleansing. And considering the onslaught, it seems unending. The question that lingers is, will the people of northern Gaza ever reclaim their homes? One of the most tragic incidents that we have seen was the bombing of a Baptist hospital in Gaza, which resulted in the loss of over 700 lives. Many of these families who had sought refuge within the hospital compound believe in the sanctity and the safety of medical institutions. They placed their trust in the international laws that clearly says that hospitals should not be targeted during conflicts and that essentials like water, electricity and food should not be withheld during wartime. And in this world where each person views events through their own lens, there's one undeniable truth. That is that innocent civilians have lost their life in crossfire. But whose perspective are we listening to? What's the narrative that has shaped our views? While I would like to give you all the slides, I believe in amplifying voices that are well-versed on the topic. And as we're all aware, the digital age has ushered in both clarity and confusion. Our social media and our social media feeds are flooded with videos and photos, each claiming to portray the realities of the conflict. But how do we separate truth from fabrication, authentic accounts from purposeful deceptions? And to help us navigate today this maze of information, we are joined by Laura Albast, a Palestinian-American journalist whose work reflects an in-depth understanding of the intricacies of this issue. Laura's voice has echoed in reputable platforms like Washington Post, The New Arab, and Al Jazeera, among others. Currently, she is the senior editor of Digital Strategy and Communications at the Institute of Palestine Studies, USA in Washington, D.C. So, hi, Laura. A warm welcome to the show. First of all, we would like to extend our heartfelt thanks because we know how busy you are, and I can only imagine the whirlwind your days must be, right? Especially when the matters that you're reporting demand such vigilance and tireless dedication.
I appreciate you hosting me.
Yeah, Laura, the The relentless pace can surely be overwhelming, right? Reporting on these issues and making sure the gravity of situation is communicated across, right?
Correct. It's a problem. Let me rephrase. It's almost like we're doing double the effort, as Palestinians and as journalists like me, who are trying to cover the genocide taking place in Gaza and also amplify voices from there at a time when electricity, internet, and all forms of communication have been cut by the Israeli regime. But then on the other hand, we're also, there's another battlefield that is happening online and in the media where we're spending a lot of our energy fighting against propaganda and lies. So instead of grieving the losses and trying to showcase the facts, we are being forced to defend our humanity. And I think that has been extremely difficult. And as you know, the news cycle is extremely fast-paced. So it's constant propaganda.
Definitely, Laura. So, first of all, before we delve into the interview, can you please clarify it for our listeners? Because you mentioned that it's important to dissect and the difference between misinformation and disinformation. Would you like to clarify that?
Of course. So, as simple as it is, misinformation is false or inaccurate information. It's getting the facts wrong. But disinformation, it's that same false information, but it is deliberately intended to mislead. So it is being spread on purpose. We can talk about a few examples regarding that, but I would classify that what is taking place in Western media and North America specifically is largely disinformation that is being spread by the Israeli government and that a lot of anchors and media professionals are just taking as fact when it is actually inaccurate.
Definitely, Laura, I would agree with you that, Western media coverage has been historically racist, to be very simple. And particularly, where I've seen a lot of news articles where Palestinians are referred to as dying while Israelis are referred to as being killed. So what would you say about reporting of major and mainstream outlets, especially in the US and Canada?
As you said, this is a pattern that we have seen over and over and over again in media coverage of Palestine. Palestinians are not killed, we simply die. But when Israeli forces, they raid our neighborhoods in the middle of the night, they bomb our children, they demolish our homes, they colonize our land and kill our people, somehow we're equal instigators. And a lot of the descriptions that are being shared by the media imply a false symmetry between occupier and occupied, propping up anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab, and Islamophobic narratives that blame the Palestinian people for Israeli aggression. We have not just seen it right now with the genocide being committed in Gaza, but we've been seeing it for many, many, many years. We can talk about 2021 during the Unity Intifada and all the incursions into Al-Aqsa Mosque and how the media, seeing footage of Israeli forces beating worshipers inside a mosque and calling it clashes and making it seem as if the worshipers who are praying to God, unarmed, doing their own thing, are apparently also instigators. We've seen it with the murder of Shireen Abu Akleh, a Palestinian journalist in Jenin. We've seen the exact same thing where the media would not admit that an Israeli sniper killed her, despite eyewitness accounts, despite the footage, despite the investigations. They refuse to admit it. There are many reasons for that, which I hope we can talk about today.
Perfect, Laura. Yeah, I agree. And talking about the stance that media has been taking, a lot of platforms and media outlets in general have been presenting, and a lot of influential figures have been taking a neutral stance when we talk about this topic. So what do you think, how it impacts the situation on ground, taking a neutral stance on this?
It is very dangerous. It is very dangerous, especially because a lot of lives are on the line in Gaza. And it's not just about the neutrality of stances, it's about also the censorship that is taking place online and in the media. A lot of us depend on journalists in Gaza, on people in the region to tell us what is going on and send us the footage that we won't see on the media. And the censorship that is taking place is really literally putting people's lives in danger because we cannot connect, but also what is being shared on by the media is putting people's lives at risk from the perspective of them sharing simply false narratives and manufacturing consent in the sense of, oh, it's okay if these people die because the viewer is not going to care. So they sort of have, they've gone to the extent of painting Palestinians as necessary casualties when they're real people, they're children. They are just people trying to live their lives. And I think it's really important to note that especially in a situation like this, being neutral means that you are standing with the oppressor. Because if you can see the footage of Palestinians being killed, the proof of what Israel is doing, the proof of Israeli officials, including the prime minister and different ministers, going public and saying the Palestinians are snakes and saying the Palestinians are human animals and admitting that they are targeting civilians, and people and influencers continue to take a neutral stand, then they are complicit in the murder of our people.
Definitely, Laura, I would agree with you. It's a very sensitive time, and taking a neutral stance just justifies your actions and your value system, I would say. And Laura, when we talk about misrepresentation of information, it seems to be that a lot of reputable news agencies, you know, they have been talking about this issue in a very biased manner for sure. But there have been a lot of instances where we have seen impersonation of reputable news agencies. For example, the Washington Post mentioned, quote unquote, that there has been created a war room by fake reporters staffed with 2,500 volunteers across Israel to combat disinformation. How do you reckon the notion of the oppressors being the one to filter what's true and what's not true?
So I'm glad you brought that up. This is actually one of the wings of the Israeli military. So in my opinion, they use terminology like war room, combating disinformation, only to appeal to the American conscience, right? So this is actually, they are part of the Israeli military. They're part of the Israeli regime. They're actually not combating any form of disinformation. If you look at their website, if you look at the things that they're posting, they are deliberately targeting Palestinian students. They're targeting allies of Palestinians. They're calling them terrorists. They're harassing them, they're doxing them, and that you can tell that there is an imbalance, because the only things that they attack, the only news that they attack, is news that is trying to be fair when it's covering Palestine. So it needs to be very clear that terminology as war room, fighting disinformation, and it's clearly coming from one side, that is not true. They are not a representative. They're not a media watchdog. The people can be the media watchdog. And I think, you know, and let's talk a little bit about the coverage that has been taking place, right? So specific claims that have come out and have been debunked, but continue to be shared, despite many organizations retracting these claims or apologizing for misleading this audience, their audiences. Let's talk about the babies. The claim of 40 beheaded babies. The journalist who broke this backtracked. She tweeted and backtracked, and she said her source was a settler soldier. And even after this news was picked up, and President Biden lied to the American people and said that he saw the images himself, his administration and his aides had to put out a statement saying that actually Biden did not see these images, and they had to retract that. The CNN, they said it on live TV, and the Sarah Snyder, the journalist who spread this piece of lie, this disinformation, she also apologized, admitting that it was unverified and that she was misled. But the damage had been done. A lot of newspapers continue to plaster and use it across all their coverage that 40 babies were beheaded, which is putting Palestinians at risk because it's causing a lot of Islamophobic tropes to be consumed by a lot of viewers. Now, let me tell you something else. What the Israeli regime has done is they started paying for ads on YouTube for children's programming, claiming that 40 babies had been killed by Hamas. And then they put the name ISIS next to Hamas. They're trying to equate Hamas with ISIS. They're trying to play on the ignorance of many viewers, not all, but many viewers, to try to show them that Arab equals terrorists. And that is a huge problem. And this is not the only one. And I'm sorry if I'm going a little over. This is not the only one. The bombing of the Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital a few days ago. The hospital has received threats from the Israeli regime repeatedly. They also received missiles around it that have exploded. The doctors themselves and the director of the hospital have repeatedly spoken up and said the Israeli regime has threatened to bomb us. When they did bomb them and killed more than 500 people, and the Israeli propaganda machine began saying that this is a Hamas misfire, don't believe them. And all these journalists starting taking that claim as truth without doing any investigation. And a few days later, when Forensic Architecture and Channel 4 in the UK actually completed an investigation, and they showed that this was an Israeli bombing, an Israeli targeting of the hospital, despite the doctors hosting a press conference in the midst of the dead bodies and telling the world Israel did this, Western journalists wouldn't believe it. And now we spent all of our energy fighting back against the bias in the Western media, telling them more than 500 people have died. Why are you focusing on who did this when we're telling you who did this? And now we've moved up. The days have passed. Israel has bombed more neighborhoods. They've bombed a church. Nobody's talking about the lives that were lost at the hospital because the lie has been cemented. And those are just two examples that I could share with you about the propaganda that's been taking place.
Yeah, I would also like to mention that related to that, there was a audio clipping put out on X, formerly Twitter, where Israeli government said that we have a recording saying that it was all done by Hamas, and later they retracted the video from the platform saying
yeah.
that yeah so yeah. That is also one of the things. Also, Laura, like you mentioned, that what matters the most right now is the context, right? The historical backdrop of 70 years that significantly influences the present dynamics of the situation. And it is often said that context is the key, right? So from your vantage point, has media succeeded in dissecting the conflict with the requisite historical and contextual depth?
Unfortunately not, but I am not surprised. If you look at all the channels and all the newspapers in the West, a lot of them start the story from October 7th. As if our struggle began on October 7, 2023, and not May 1948. So a lot of them are missing that context. And the issue is, and I'll tell you why, it's because in this cycle, in this specific news cycle, because there has been an attack on Israeli settlements, then Western media only cares about European white settlers. They do not care when we have been attacked for days and months and years and decades every single day. Anybody who follows the news in Palestine knows that there's a raid almost every day in the West Bank. They know that Israel has had a blockade on the Gaza Strip for 17 years, that they control everything from electricity to the amount of calories that go into who is allowed to leave and who is allowed to enter. They know that Palestinians have zero control over providing themselves with any basic needs, that Israel controls everything. They know that Israel has killed children. They know that Israel has raids homes and arrests people in the middle of the night for absolutely no reason. But none of this is on the media unless we fight back.
Are Are you tired of Big Brother bookstores trying to sell you some billionaire's favorite book or Heather's top picks? Then you should check out Vancouver Books. Vancouver Books is a new online family-run bookstore. A portion of their profits go to First Nations reconciliation and environmental projects in British Columbia. They provide their customers with the most interesting books in fine arts, signed first editions, First Nations photography, fine ancient books, occult, and so much more. They also provide carbon-free delivery to anywhere in the Vancouver area. So go to www.vancouverbooks.ca to check out Vancouver Books today. That's www.vancouverbooks.ca. Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% Indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or grocery checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek
Coffee.
How are
you that Vancouver has a housing problem?
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
And we have marched peacefully. We have marched on the borders peacefully. We have protested. We have called for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. We have sat on the tables and had conversations. We have been diplomatic. We have done all everything that they demand us to do, but they do not accept us and they do not see us when we are peaceful. They only see us when we fight back. And this is a problem because they equate violence and fear to Palestinians and Arabs, and that is inaccurate and it is unfair. And what I do want to focus on as well is there are some producers and reporters and writers who are trying to fight back, who are trying to push back. Let me remind you, in 2021, I think about 500 or more Canadian journalists wrote an open letter calling for fair coverage in Canadian media, and many of them were actually removed from their posts or fired. The same thing happened in the United States. Hundreds of American journalists wrote an open letter calling for fair coverage in the media, and there were also repercussions to that. Today, we're having the same thing happen. Hundreds of American journalists have written an open media letter again calling for fair media coverage. A lot of them are trying to get Gaza voices into the coverage. They're trying to get Palestinian perspectives. But as we have seen in a lot of the coverage that has been going on, I'll give you specific examples. A lot of the higher up management of these organizations, these media outlets, have intervened to erase the Palestinian voice. Specifically, let's talk about MSNBC or the Palestinian narrative. Let's talk about MSNBC. MSNBC has removed three of its Muslim anchors from their seats, from their shows since October 7. And those are Ayman Ismail, Ali Velshi, and Mehdi Hassan. And that is because all three of them, when they do their coverage on Palestine, they actually provide fair coverage. And internal documents have shown that there is a lot of internal disagreement at MSNBC regarding how the channel is handling coverage on Palestine. We also saw Palestinian experts like Omar Badar, Noura Ariqat, Youssef Munayyer get booked as experts to go speak on shows like CNN and CBC and multiple other organic media outlets in the US. And at the last minute, their participation is either canceled or not broadcasted or posted after the interview is done. And also investigations that have been done by Jewish Currents and other media outlets in North America, they've shown that there has been an intervention from higher up management at these outlets that said, oh, they're making us look bad, so let's not post this. Or, oh, we don't want them to talk about this, so we're just going to cancel their segment completely. So I think today we have a little more evidence, tangible evidence that shows that there is a deliberate move within media organizations to silence Palestinians. And I hope that this changes, but people are trying to fight from within. It's just extremely difficult.
So Laura, now you mentioned that there was a slight delay in the interview today due to the coverage of a recent protest that you were reporting on, right? So the sea must be swarming with emotions and urgency, but given the substantial impact of the sheer scale of demonstrations and protest, yeah. I was just curious that were there significant number of media outlets presenting who were covering the protest?
So let me tell you something. There are a lot of media organizations that do come out to different protests happening in DC and New York and Montreal, wherever it is in North America. But the problem is that we're not given as much airtime. A lot of the media outlets that come out are classified, you can say, as friendly media outlets that are either local to the area or outlets that are more, you know, tailored towards international audiences like Al Jazeera, TRT, Al Arabi, whatever that outlet is. So there is an effort of trying to collect that footage, but not a lot of it is being aired. And we can see sometimes on Twitter, some journalists go to the extent of saying, oh, this protest is like, there was a protest, on the West Coast in the US a few days ago. And some random journalist, American journalist, was saying this protest is embarrassingly small. There's not a lot of people coming out. But when you look at the footage that has been posted online, that has been covered of that particular protest, there were thousands of people. So there is a little bit of a media blackout of sort that is trying to show that people are not angry when people are in fact angry. And it's not just Palestinians that are coming out. It's everybody with a conscience. It is everybody who supports Palestine, who supports the liberation of Palestine from our Jewish brothers and sisters, our Black brothers and sisters, our Indigenous brothers and sisters. And we saw it on Capitol Hill on Wednesday. Hundreds of Jewish allies went to the Capitol in Washington, D.C., and they went to Congress. They had a sit-in. They prayed and chanted and called for a ceasefire, right? So this was shown a little bit on TV. It's been shown around, but it has not been fixated on. But it is very important. We're talking about not just Arabs and Palestinians going out to protest. We're talking about Jewish people and Americans themselves coming out and saying, we do not agree with what Israel is doing. We want Palestine to be liberated.
Yes, Laura, and to make conscious decisions, I feel that informed reporting is something that is of paramount importance. So in the era of information overload, what would you say, how would you distinguish between authentic news and disinformation, and how can an average person dissect between the two, especially with the evolving nature of the platforms like X, formerly known as Twitter again? So what advice would you offer to individuals to make a conscious choice and conscious decisions for themselves, and how to navigate the landscape?
Listen, I know that the consumption of the media can be overwhelming sometimes, especially when there is so much information out there to read. But there are easy steps to take to just fact check. And you don't have to be an expert to fact check. Let's say you're on Twitter. Unfortunately, you know, the platform X, Twitter, what Elon Musk has done, he has allowed anybody and everybody to get a verified, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of tweets are going viral that seemingly come from verified accounts, but these are just, you know, trolls, or they're not really verified sources of information. To give you an example of that, a few days ago, there was this fake account. I forgot the exact name of the individual, but she had a name that sounded, you know, Muslim, South Asian name. She said that she was with Al Jazeera, and she started tweeting things that are related to the disinformation campaign that Israel has put out, claiming that that no, Israel did not bomb the hospital. Al Jazeera had to put out a statement and say that this individual does not exist, is not an employee, they have nobody in their organization with that name, and they had to come out and tell the public, like, be cautious of who you're reading. So I think one thing is, if you are on Twitter, go to these pages and check if these people are actually verified, or did they pay for their verification. That's number one. Number two, if you're watching a news outlet or you're reading something and there is a direct quote from an Israeli official or an Israeli government official, you need to ask the question yourself, is what he's saying true? Or is that only a way for him to convince the viewers that what they're doing to the Palestinians is okay? I don't think that journalists, Western journalists, take any government's voice as truth anywhere in the world except for Israel. When they covered Russia and Ukraine, if a Russian official was saying something about Ukraine, they would challenge that. They would ask questions. They would go and verify. The same thing with any other dictatorship or nation around the world. Nobody ever takes the government's word. So why are they taking Israel's word? Right? Lies have been proven that it's been proven that they have been lying. So those are two things that I would specifically just when you're consuming the media, just slow down a little bit and ask yourself the question, who is saying this? Why would they say this? Is this true? Is there somewhere I could look for to see if this is true? So that's number one. Is the journalist asking the questions that I have, or are they just taking that claim without challenging it? There is another responsibility that we have. You know, we're not just media consumers or media producers. We can also be media watchdogs. Those media outlets, they serve us. We can pick up the phone, write letters to the editor, and ask for fair coverage and ask the questions that they are not asking. We can call our members of parliament and demand that they ask for a ceasefire, that they demand for more representation and fair coverage on Palestine. We have a role. We supposedly live in democracies. So let us take our right, let us use that right and stand up for what is right. It does not matter. People are dying. We know who is killing them. We cannot stay silent.
Yes. Thank you so much, Laura. So you've heard it, folks, how difficult and how important the situation is. And I know that it's hard standing for something so demonized by Western media. I know, listeners, that you are hearing the voices of the oppressor louder than ever while simultaneously watching the death toll rise. And I know some days it just feels like a losing battle. But it's very important to trust the process and to know that the narrative will change and that change depends on you. So it all starts from taking informed choices and making informed decisions for yourself and making conscious decisions. So yes, it takes an immense amount of bravery and it takes immense amount of bravery to stand against the popular opinion. But get out there, be informed and make informed choices. And thank you so much, Laura, for this right step in the direction that we are trying to move in. Thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you so much for having me. And maybe if I could say just one more thing, you know, maybe the listeners are listening to this and they feel, oh, you know, Palestine is miles and miles away. Why should we care? It's not affecting us. Maybe you guys don't know. Maybe some of your friends are not Muslim. They're not Arab. Maybe you feel that you're not directly affected, but remember that you are. Because of the Western media bias that have taken place in the United States, a landlord went into the home of a Palestinian American family and stabbed a 6-year-old child while he yelled, "Muslims, all Muslims must die." What the media is doing is directly influencing a lot of people, a lot of extremists, a lot of ignorant people, possibly wherever you are living, and they are inciting them against people of color. It does not just affect us as Palestinians or Arabs or Muslims. My friend lives in New York. She is a Hindu. She is not a Muslim. She's not a Palestinian. She's not even an Arab. She had Islamophobic slurs thrown at her just because of her skin color. This affects all of us. If we do not stand against the Islamophobic tropes that are spewed by Canadian and American and British media, then it is all going to backfire on all of us. We will not be safe in our own countries. We need to stand up for what is right to protect everybody, because we cannot be free. We cannot have peace if we are not all free. And that means that Palestine needs to be free first.
It's worth noting that Canada, a nation that is obviously close to many of our hearts and is our home,
was among the first to recognize the state of Israel back in 1948. However, the ripple effects of the Israel-Hamas conflict have raised concern on Canadian soil as well, concerning the disturbing rise in both Islamophobia and antisemitism. There are countless Canadians, some possibly our neighbors or friends, who are mourning the loss of family members in the region. While the numbers of death continue to mount, another kind of pain is being felt right here, the sting of hateful narratives. To delve deeper into Canada's position, we are honored to have Shada with us today. As a Palestinian refugee and dedicated organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement in Toronto, Shada embodies the spirit of resilience. The movement reminds us that Palestinian youth, even miles away from their homeland, haven't given up the fight for freedom and the dream of returning home. So hello, Shada. Thanks for joining us today on the show.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
We're so glad to have you, Shada. So before we get into the discussion, Shada, I would like to take a moment to touch on the journey of Palestinian youth movement, a cause that undeniably holds a significant place in the current narrative. So given the prevalent environment where misinformation has overshadowed the truth, I'm just curious to know how you've navigated through these challenges and how has this atmosphere of false narratives impacted you personally and extended its effects on the organization practices at the grassroots levels?
For sure. So this misinformation campaign, these one-sided narratives that we're seeing pushed by the media, by our politicians, regurgitating, you know, IDF talking points, Zionist talking points, don't only have implications to, you know, generate or manufacture consent for genocide back home, but this has also led to a rise in hate crimes against Palestinians, Muslims, and Arabs. You have the case in Montreal where a woman in her car with a Palestinian flag was attacked and was told by an author that she should be, you know, raped in front of her kids and dragged to the streets. And then you saw in Chicago a few days ago the tragic case of the brutal murder of Wadia, who was a 6-year-old Palestinian boy who was stabbed 26 times. So this narrative, this misinformation has real life implications here.
Yes, so Sada, I agree with you. But talking back to the basics, Canada's classification on Hamas as a terrorist organization back in 2022, it's notable that evolved to a two-state solution. And over the years, there has been a shift. And, you know, from two-state solution, we have been seeing a more pro-Israel stance. So can you share your insights on this?
Yes. So the two-state solution is essentially a non-solution, and it's just a way to cement the status quo between colonizer and colonized. So the two-state solution was an agreement that was mediated by the United States with the contingency that Palestinians would abandon their struggle for total liberation and would abandon their right of return. So what the right of return is the right for Palestinian refugees that were violently ethnically cleansed and displaced from their land to return to their ancestral homelands. And you have a refugee population of over 7 million and Palestinians who have been living in refugee camps for 4 or 5 generations. And the two-state solution also ushered in a security collaboration between the Palestinian Authority and the colonial Israeli regime, where it essentially acts like an arm of the occupation. It's like a cheap military contractor. It surveils its own population, like it will give up Palestinian children who threw rocks, for example, and have them imprisoned to the occupation. And even with this so-called two-state solution, Israel has never locked in its borders. So Israel is the only country in the world with a never-ending expansionist policy. And you can see that with the expansion of the settlements all over the West Bank. There's over 140 now, and there's more than 100 checkpoints. And this settlement expansion is a violent process within itself, because this entails demolishing Palestinian homes, violent dispossession, disenfranchisement, and the influx of violent settlers armed to the teeth by the Israeli government and protected by the occupation forces. Ben-Gvir just announced that he's going to arm them with 10,000 more rifles. And this has led to 2023 being the most deadly year for Palestinians in the West Bank yet. So the two-state solution was never a pro-Palestinian stance within itself. It is a pro-Israel stance. It's a liberal veneer meant to maintain the status quo and to further dispossess Palestinians. So I don't necessarily see it being a, you know, weird shift. This is the natural conclusion from a two-state solution. The natural conclusion is a pro-Israel stance.
Listen without distraction.
Listen to Breakfast with the Browns every Monday morning.
Half from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
Something that just offers you the place, the chance to stay in a mood.
Breakfast with the Browns.
The best in ambient, downtempo, electronic, ASMR. Pop loungcore music. Totally Alpha Wave.
On CITR 101.9 FM.
Thus, the most ordinary movement in the world may agitate a thousand odd disconnected fragments. Now bright, now dim. Hanging and bobbing and dipping and flaunting.
So, beauty remains in the impossibilities of the body.
You know that, don't you? Wake up.
Okay, Shada, thank you for clarifying that. And when we talk about Canada, usually Canada often prides itself on upholding the principle of freedom of speech, right? And recent controversies and resignations have surfaced in the political arenas of both Canada and US. For example, NDP MPP Sarah Jama was asked to resign. And then we have this recent incident where Air Canada pilot Mustafa was dismissed following his pro-Palestinian posts. So do you think that these incidents reflect a change in how freedom of speech is exercised in Canada?
Most definitely. What we've seen in the last couple of weeks is a chilling climate. It is a crackdown of freedom of speech, but also it's a crackdown on the right for Palestinian communities to organize against the genocide and colonial violence that our people have been subjected to for decades. So Palestinians, their allies, Canadians from all walks of life, went to the streets after the events of October 7th in order to preemptively organize against what we knew would be a genocide. What happened was Doug Ford, Olivia Chow, alongside other politicians across Canada, condemned the protests and attempted to tie Palestinian organizing to Hamas, which is insane. But what this leads to is high surveillance, high repression. And if I could just read Olivia Chow's tweet, because this tweet was sent by Zionist organizations to politicians in Vancouver, in Montreal, and Ottawa. And her tweet reads, "The government of Canada has rightly listed Hamas as a terrorist organization, and we simply must not tolerate any support of terror, full stop. The rally to support Hamas at Nathan Phillips Square today is unsanctioned without a permit, and I unequivocally denounce it. Glorifying this weekend's indiscriminate violence, including murder and kidnapping of women and children by Hamas against Israeli civilians, is deplorable. And I am receiving updates from the chief of police, who assures me they will investigate and address any suspected hate speech." So what you're seeing is a likening of any support for the Palestinian cause for freedom to material support for terror.
Mm-hmm. Definitely in the scenario of political turmoil, a lot of people have been trying to voice out their opinions, and there have been protests going on. And considering the recent development, where a substantial number of artists and academics, over 3,500 to be very exact, have publicly expressed solidarity with Palestine, do you believe these type of collective stances could change the prevailing narrative or could make a political shift in the system?
I definitely do. I think that these statements are critical. These statements show that despite the one-sided narrative we see in the media from our politicians, we see that the masses support the right for the liberation of the homeland, for freedom, and for dignity, and that even though these institutions attempt to repress these popular statements, to intimidate people into silence, the people are unwilling to be complicit in the crimes of their government. So it's critical that we see these statements keep coming out.
Yes, Shada. Also, I would like to mention it to my listeners that Canada was among the pioneering nations to recognize State of Israel back in 1948. And since then, the countries have cultivated an extensive relationship. A lot of people like to call it friends with benefits. So this relationship spans over various sectors, including military, cybersecurity, agriculture, technology, alternative energy, seemingly benefiting Israeli regime. So how do you think the long-standing relationship has influenced Canada's current stance? And do you think in any way, if Canada takes a different stance, it could leverage its political ties to affect change?
I'm so sorry, you cut out from cyber technology. If you could repeat the question.
So I was just saying that the relationship of Canada and Israel goes way back. It spans across various sectors, including military, cybersecurity, agriculture, alternative energy, that has benefited Israeli regime, right? So how do you think this long-standing relationship and the history that is there has influenced Canada's current stance? And do you think, if any way Canada has to take a different stance, it will change the entire narrative and it can actually affect change?
Yes. So the Canadian government has shown time and time again that they unequivocally stand with Israel. Canada can play a role, but they choose to support, endorse, and fund war crimes. In just the past 12 days, we've seen bombings of hospitals. Just yesterday, they called Al-Quds Hospital and they told them to evacuate. This is 400 patients and 12,000 people seeking shelter, bombing churches, white phosphorus. The death toll is 4,500 now. So Canada should be taking a stand against this, considering how Canada positions itself as a peacekeeping nation. But we're seeing this be exposed yet again, and that this is not the case for Canada. So this is a relationship that has supported 75 years of colonization. It should take a stand, but its relationship allows for the continued violence against Palestinians.
Definitely. And despite knowing the fact that Canada has been exporting military support to Israel since 1996, and you know, especially in 2021, marking a significant rise in military goods exported valued at $27.8 million, right? So how would you say, is Canada directly funding genocide and ethnic cleansing, would you say?
Absolutely. So Israel tests their weapons and security technology on Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. So this is a captive population, an occupied population. And in the case of Gaza, this is 2.2 million people held hostage. The military tests these weapons on them. Then they go to military conventions and advertise the war crimes committed using this technology as proof of its capabilities. And the idea that Israeli arms industry benefits from the occupation through having a captive population that it can test its weaponry on is widely accepted. It markets them, it presents them as battle proven to the international market. So essentially, the occupation is a laboratory for its weapons. And the arms industry is dominated in Israel by four companies, Elbit Systems being the biggest one. And in 2020, Canada signed a $36 million contract with Elbit Systems. And the contract was for a civilian version of Elbit's lethal military drone, the Hermes 900. And the Hermes 900 made its operational debut in the 2014 attack on Gaza, where Israeli drones caused the murder of 840 Palestinians, and there's 164 of those children. So these arms trades, these military contracts absolutely fund the genocide and the murder and the dispossession of Palestinians back home. And there needs to be an arms embargo. This is disgusting. And we should not allow our government to use our taxes to fund this genocide and not allow us to be complicit in their war crimes.
Yes, Shada, also the Jewish National Fund has played a pivotal role in the ethnic cleansing of Palestinian villages since the early days of Zionism, right? So its Canadian branch has notably developed Canada Park over the ruins of three villages that were seized in 1967, with the JNF, Jewish National Fund, enjoying charitable status and raising millions of tax-free in Canada. What are your thoughts on this scenario?
Yes, so the JNF has not just, you know, played a role in the colonization of Palestine, it's played a pivotal role in the colonization of Palestine. And this is something that started 120 years ago. It's one of the main engines for the colonization of Palestinian lands and the displacement of Palestinians, and it owns 13% of occupied Palestine in 48 territories. So that is crazy. And the JNF having charitable status in Canada means that they are tax exempt. So Canadians are footing the bill for colonialism. They're footing the bill for the violent and forced removal of Palestinians from their homes, from the forcible displacement of Palestinians, and for land theft that leads to home demolitions and the continued colonization of Palestine. And this charitable status is being allowed to still continue with this charitable status in the midst of a genocide. And the JNF is having a fundraiser in Toronto in the upcoming month, which it should not be allowed to. It should have its charitable status revoked. And it's never been penalized for its repeated violation of both Canadian law and international law.
Yes, Shada. So talking about the last one, closing discussion on this note, I would just like to say that, as you know, that 150 Canadian citizens are trapped in Israel along with, to be noted, 2 million Palestinians. And you know that it's almost impossible for Palestinians to go out of Gaza. So how would you say that, how the efforts of Canadian government has been evacuating its citizens from the affected regions, and has Canada been successful in it? And what are your thoughts on that, please, Inlay?
So Canada has been working on evacuating people from Israel, but there has been no consideration for the Palestinian Canadians living in Gaza, who are living under genocidal bombardment. They are still there. Or those of us that are Canadian with families in Gaza. And for people who don't know, Gaza has been under a land, sea, and air siege for 17 years. This is what has been described as the world's largest open air prison. 47% of this population is children. This is 2.2 million people crowded in one of the most densely populated areas in the entire world. Before the bombing campaign, the Israeli defense minister called them human animals using genocidal rhetoric. They have bombed hospitals, churches, schools, used white phosphorus, which is a war crime to use. And now there's more than 1.5 million Palestinians internally displaced. And the death toll is more than 4,500. So Canada has focused on its quote unquote solidarity with Israel, its unequivocal support for Israel, which is the norm, but it has emboldened Israel to continue its genocidal campaign. And there is a clearly different value ascribed to Israeli Canadians than there is with Palestinian Canadians. And that is not only very clear now, but this violence that we're seeing has existed for more than 75 years, and not once has Canada looked into the safety of its Canadian Palestinians or those Canadians with families in Palestine and in Gaza, or looked to reassess its stance with Israel.
Thank you, Shada, for such insightful views. And I'm pretty sure that we are trying to change the narrative and we are on our way, and maybe we will be about to see the change. So before we end the discussion, Shada, do you have anything to, or do you have any messages for our listeners?
Yes. First of all, thank you so much for having me. But the last thing that I would say is that the reason why we've seen so much repression and so much demonization of Palestinians is the media scrambling, trying to, you know, push down any dissent. But what we have seen with protests in Canada and protests around the world is the masses, the people, do not want to be complicit in this genocide. The people say no to ethnic cleansing. The people say no to genocide, and that they should continue going out in the streets, marching, refusing to allow their governments to continue these war crimes, to continue to fund these war crimes, to support these war crimes. They should not allow this chilling climate to censor them, and they should continue to speak up until we see a Gaza that does not have to live in a siege and a Palestine that is free.
Yes, Shada, definitely. And before we end the discussion, I would just like to end it on a note where you all can just think about this and make informed decisions. I would just like to ask one thing: if your city was besieged and occupied and your people were brutalized every single day for 75 years, listeners, would you be the perfect victim?
Lastly, to give us yet another perspective, we have a brave student from UBC who has been on the front lines showing solidarity for Palestine. To ensure their safety, we've chosen to keep their identity anonymous. But we deeply appreciate their willingness to help us to see things a little bit more clearer. So let's make sure that we embark on this journey of understanding, and may empathy be our guide.
Thank you so much for having me and for giving me the platform. And I do want to quickly mention that it is quite unfortunate that most organizers for Palestine have to be really, really careful about their identities, because there seems to be a current against Palestinian organizing, and there seems to be some sort of like demonizing or demonization for the work that we do, even though all we want is for Palestinians to live in peace, and for the ongoing genocide to stop, and for the occupation to cease in Palestine, which don't seem that radical, but so many people seem to have problems with these demands. I've been mostly and primarily working in activism on campus, like campus activism, in collaboration with some city partners, but essentially the main body that I've been organizing in collaboration with lately is SPHR, or Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights, which is student-run organization on campus that does educational work, educating people about Palestine, cultural work, keeping Palestinian culture alive, and celebrating it, essentially celebrating all the beautiful aspects of Palestinian culture. Also political work, which has been the main thing we're doing lately, advocating for Palestinians' rights, both at home in Palestine and in the diaspora. And we also do a lot of communal work, providing Palestinian students and those with ties to the lands of Palestine with the community, which has come in super handy at times like this, when people need support, and when they need to vent, and when they need to feel like they are not alone. It has been so disappointing, the response that we've been seeing, because even if we were just for a moment to look at what happened since October 7th, there was so much mourning and so much light shed on the attack that Hamas perpetrated against Israelis. And there was like so many news organizations covering it in detail, in a very biased way, but in detail still. But once the retaliation from the Israeli side started, the reaction was so very completely different, especially from people who claim to be social justice warriors and who claim to be activists. It has been very disappointing. And I think the past few days, more than anything, have shown me that racism and white supremacy are not textbook concepts. They very much exist. Palestinian death seem to be no more than numbers to people, although the great majority of them are really children. But the more important thing to address with regards to your question is this idea of context, because people seem to think that just because they found out about Israel-Palestine on October 7th, that means that it has started on October 7th, which it really hasn't, right? Actually, the land of Palestine, which is currently occupied by Israel, was first occupied in 1948. And before we even talk about 1948, we need to go back for a moment and talk about Zionism as a project. So Zionism is an ideology, a secular ideology that was founded by Theodor Herzl, a Russian ethnically Jewish writer and thinker who wrote about this idea of establishing a Jewish homeland for people, for Jews who were persecuted in Europe. And there were actually so many areas and countries that were kind of assessed for this project. But in 1917, Balfour, which was then the Prime Minister of the UK, promised the land of Palestine, which was under the British mandate at the time, to proponents of this project. Because obviously there are some ties there, like to this land for like ethnically and religiously Jewish people. That is something that we will never deny. Obviously, there were Palestinian Jews long before the occupation, and Palestinian Jews continue to exist to this day. But also because it was a great chance to kind of get like an ally in the then thriving region, both like resource-wise and geopolitically. And so in 1948, after the Holocaust, so many Jews that survived the Holocaust were sent to Palestine to seek refuge. And for a few years after their arrival, they actually held Palestinian passports. In 1948, the occupation process started with support from both the US and the UK. It was a war. But the land wasn't necessarily only lost at war. It was also a very systematic process of land dispossession that lasted years, where Palestinians were removed from much of the historic land of Palestine, and they were concentrated in the West Bank and Gaza. And both these areas over time kind of continued to shrink. Fast forward, because there's so much history there, but fast forward to modern day Israel. It is something that Amnesty International, the Human Rights Watch, that every credible and recognized human rights organization describes as an apartheid state. There are literal walls separating Palestinians from Israelis, Palestinians from each other. There are, in Israel, there are Arab roads and Jewish roads. There are roads that Arabs are simply not allowed to take. There are checkpoints that people have to go through. A simple trip to the supermarket can take you so much longer if a checkpoint happens to be along your way. A distance that could normally be covered in 20 minutes because you can't go through the Jewish roads could take you up to 5 hours because you have to go around and stop at all these checkpoints. And then most importantly, while Palestinians do not have a right to return to their historic homeland, be it the West Bank and Gaza or the rest of so-called Israel, on the other hand, there was this law in 2018 that stated that any person of Jewish religion or ancestry can come to Israel and live in Israel and benefit from all the resources in Israel just by virtue of being Jewish, even if they have zero connection to the land, which the majority of people who live in Israel currently, which are mostly dual citizens and mostly white, are. They have no connection to the land. They are not the ethnic Jews of Palestine that used to live there before the 1948 occupation. So essentially, that brings us to the question of Gaza and to the question of October 7th. And Gaza specifically has been living under a blockade, a complete blockade, where Israel controls every single thing that goes in and out of its borders. There's zero trade with the rest of the world. There's zero business that is not sanctioned by the state of Israel inside of Gaza. People are not allowed to go in or out. Cancer patients in Gaza have to get special permits, and even then they're only allowed to go into the West Bank or Israel for treatment by themselves. They're not allowed to take a chaperone or a parent, even in the case of it being a child. And so there is so much discrimination, there is so much prejudice, and understandably, there's so much anger that's been brewing in Gaza for years. Now, I'm not saying that civilian life should not be mourned. It most definitely should. But I also think that it's very misguided to start thinking about what happened to the Israeli civilians without contextualizing it into how it was the Israeli state, in fact, that was the reason behind that level of anger. They were even the ones that that funded Hamas at its onset for political purposes. Mm-hmm. So in every way, I'm inclined to find or to assign the responsibility for this attack to the Israeli government, rather than only to the people who perpetrated the attack on the ground. I think you only need to be a human being with a consciousness and a conscience to know that what's happening in Palestine is unacceptable, and what's been happening in Palestine since 1948 and the insane death toll that anyone can like easily look up on the internet is just completely unacceptable. But more importantly, I think that it is a mistake to boil Palestine down to this as like a Arab issue, like an Arab issue or a Muslim issue or just an issue of Palestinians, because just last week we saw more than 500 Jewish folks storm the American Congress and say, not in our name. Like, do not commit genocide in our name. Do not exploit our grief to commit genocide. Mm-hmm. And so there is this misconception that people who organize for Palestine or who advocate for Palestine have something against the Jewish community or have something against Jews in general, which in all my years of activism and in all my years as a like an Arab Middle Eastern person surrounded by Arab people, I've never found to be true. We always continue to condemn those like voices on the peripheries who would engage in like anti-Semitic rhetoric. I really think that's completely unacceptable, because our issue is not with who, in whose name these atrocities are being committed. It's with the fact that the atrocities are being committed. And so Palestine is not a Muslim issue. And it's not an Arab issue, it's a human issue. And it's also not, like, Palestinian activism is not against Jews, it's against injustice. And it completely rejects anti-Semitism in any of its forms, because it's such a real issue. I just don't think that advocating for Palestine and saying free Palestine is in any way, shape, or form a propagation of anti-Semitism. And I think that if people don't think that Palestine is a feminist issue or that it's a queer issue, then they really don't understand the issue as it currently is or as it always has been. Because right now in Gaza, there are pregnant women who are due soon, very soon. I was reading a quantification of it, and it's 50,000, around 50,000 pregnant women, and around 5,000 of them are due in the next month or so. And the hospitals are not only getting bombed, but also running out of all kinds of supply. Mm-hmm. How is that not a feminist issue? And Palestinian women in Gaza are running out of sanitary products because there's absolutely no aid that has thus far entered Gaza as we speak today on Friday. So how is that not a feminist issue? And I also have been disappointed by a lot of queer activists in the social justice circles, mm-hmm. who are like, yeah, I don't know why I would advocate for Palestine if I wouldn't last a day in Palestine, or like Palestinians don't like me. But it's also, it's crazy to think that, because on the on the one hand, do you really think the missiles ask people if they are queer first before hitting them? And do you really think that there are no queer people in Gaza? If anything, if the climate is not ripe for education and progress in Gaza, it's because of everything that's been going on. Mm-hmm. How are people supposed to like accept ideals that may be new to them if they don't have access to basic education and basic curriculums? And the history of Canadian law too, by the early settlers, like, it's steeped in homophobia. And so I just find it so weird that very educated queer activists find it difficult to understand that the queer people in Gaza, well, everyone in Gaza, but especially for queer activists, queer people in Gaza deserve your attention, and they deserve for you to call for that ceasefire for their protection. Just because they can't be out and proud like you have the privilege to be, mm-hmm. doesn't mean that they don't deserve for us to advocate in their name. I kind of want to like pick up on the kind of aftermath that that leads to, when the media coverage is so biased and it's so one-sided, and it's is quite often dehumanizing of Palestinians.
Oh, yeah.
The aftermath of that is that a six-year-old child in Illinois, in Chicago, was murdered by his landlord, who used to play with him and who he used to have a good relationship with. But this landlord, who I'm guessing was like marinating in Fox News for a few days probably, broke into the apartment, stabbed the child 26 times, screaming that Muslims and Palestinians don't deserve to live and they all deserve to die. Mm-hmm. And that's the more extreme end of it. But also, we are seeing the consequences of this kind of reporting here on campus, where I know from folks at SPHR that they have been receiving really, really horrific emails, death threats even, for their activism for Palestine. I know that the material that they're placing around campus is being taken down. So yeah, even on campus, it hasn't been a safe space. The problem is SPHR is getting so many complaints about different like little fires, but also bigger fires that they need to put off, in terms of the unsafety of Palestinian students and those expressing solidarity on campus. For example, just earlier this week, a girl was wearing a kfir, which is a symbol of Palestinian solidarity, walking mm-hmm. around campus when she got followed by who she assumes is a man, who was screaming at her, mm-hmm. Saying, like, you're supporting terrorism, take that shit off, and just being really, really vile. And she was genuinely worried for her safety. But to an even bigger extent, there is a professor on campus who gave a really horrifying lecture just last week, comparing Palestinians and Gazans to Hitler, saying that there is absolutely nothing wrong with cutting off food and water and fuel from Gaza because it's a retaliatory measure, saying that that this attack was no different than 9/11. And so just invoking all these images of Hitler, Nazism, and 9/11, and we all know the kind of aftermath that mm-hmm. befell Muslims on, like, after 9/11, especially here in the West, like,
definitely
all the hate crimes and all the unsafety. And so the fact that there is a professor on campus, a political science professor, no least, who is invoking these images and who is, quite frankly, scaring and instilling fear in Palestinian students, and not even letting them debate him back. He did not give them a chance to say, well, you might not be right. Every time they tried to speak back up, he would shut them down. Some students even reported that he would laugh back at them. And eventually, when they got up to leave, he looked at them and said, do you not find this important? So it's akin to bullying. Mm-hmm. And if this is coming from a professor who's supposed to be educated and who's supposed to be critical, what can we expect from people who uncritically consume the news, which mm-hmm. many people in this country uncritically consume the news? So campus has been unsafe, to say the least, and we worry day in and day out organizing for Palestine, which again is so shameful because I never thought that there would be a day where genocide becomes so normalized and becomes so debatable. I'm just gonna add quickly that the statements that have that the university's been putting out so far have been so disappointing to Palestinian folks especially, but also all of us doing Palestinian activism. The university does not even use the word Palestine in its statements. There is no both sidism even. Like, they're so clear on where they stand and that it is against Palestine and Palestinians. And again, like, the departmental statements haven't been any better. So essentially, we're walking around thinking, who is really, like, mourning for our people? Who's mourning for Palestinians as we're walking around, if everyone seems to be so steadfast on taking the Israeli government's side?
Mm-hmm.
We haven't seen the university come out and say anything about genocide, about the countless victims that have fallen in Gaza so far. Yeah, it's honestly heartbreaking. Like, it's so difficult because I listen to these numbers, and I'm sorry I'm getting a bit flustered, but I listen to these numbers, and again, like, the Western media wants us to think of them as just numbers. Mm-hmm. Collateral damage is a word I've heard a lot. Casualties is a word I've heard a lot. But also, every single one of these people had dreams and hopes and a life and a family and people who cared about them that may or may not survive them.
Mm-hmm.
And yesterday, before going to bed, I was reading a couple of stories about two people that died in the hospital bombing, and then another person that died in this church bombing, which is a whole other atrocity on its own.
Mm-hmm.
And just listening to, like, them being humanized to their stories, to what they loved, what they hated, what made them tick, how long they've been trying to have kids that will now grow up without them.
Mm-hmm.
It's so heartbreaking to think about all these casualties, and yet the university stays silent. A university that prides itself on being the most international campus in North America.
Yeah.
The most international campus in North America that knows for a fact that it has so many Palestinian Arab Muslim students,
mm-hmm.
is staying silent to our pain, our suffering, and our loss of loved ones. There are people in this university who have family in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
There might not be too many of them, but they're still worth showing up for, aren't they? One of the tricks that the media is trying to play on us is this idea that we are helpless. We are watching helplessly. Like, you hear this word being repeated a lot. Like, you know, sure, even if they acknowledge that there are casualties falling, the politicians will deal with it, you know? And I think that's completely untrue. I think there's so much in our hands to do. First of all, right after you finish listening to this episode, look up your MP. Find out who your MP is. There are two numbers to each MP, one for their office in Ottawa and one for their office in the constituency. Call both of them and say, I am a member of your constituency. I voted for you, or even if you didn't, and I'm demanding that you call on Canada to demand a ceasefire and to let humanitarian aid make its way into Gaza. So that's one thing that I really hope everyone takes part in. Keep showing up to demonstrations. They are quite literally a demonstration of the number of Canadians and people living in Canada who are calling for this to happen. So keep showing up to demonstration. We have a power in numbers, and we always, like, we've always said, the workers united will never be defeated, and it's the same idea. The activists united will never be defeated. So keep showing up to demos, donate, to trust incredible sources. Aid is not currently making it into Gaza, sure, but the moment this is over, Lord knows when and how, but the moment this is over, they are going to need so many resources, financial and otherwise, to rebuild, to treat the sick, to treat the injured, to treat the wounded, and to basically bring Gaza back to life. Mm-hmm. So make sure that you're donating. Find the SPHR in your community. There is always like there's the Palestinian Youth Movement in Vancouver. There is Salmadoon, which is another like Palestine Solidarity Network in Vancouver. Find a solidarity network. So all these things, show up to the demos, call your MPs, keep posting, keep correcting misinformation online. Make sure that you're staying informed. And the last thing I will ask of everyone is please stay sensitized. Don't get desensitized to what's happening. No matter how many of them we see fall dead, no matter how many horrific videos on the internet, the reality is so much worse. And every single one of these people is a human life, a sacred human life that did not deserve what happened to it. So stay engaged, stay sensitized. And I'm sorry, I lied. This is the last thing. The last thing I want to ask of all of you is to stay with Palestine after this cools down. Because we don't know this time around how things are going to turn out, because it's so much bigger than ever and the U.S. is not allowing the ceasefire to happen. But we know that however this ends, it's going to be just the very beginning of Palestinian liberation. And so calling for a ceasefire is a great start because people need to stop falling dead. But it's not an end in and of itself. Mm-hmm. Calling for a ceasefire is just so that we can create a ripe ground for diplomatic conversations about ending the occupation, about ending apartheid. And for those conversations to happen, we need to keep the pressure on and we need to keep advocating for Palestine, even after the ceasefire hopefully happens. If you have a Palestinian friend, if you have a friend working in activism at all, please do check up on them. We're trying to stay strong and we're trying to play it cool because we know that we're going to be in this for the long haul, but we need all the support that we can get. So check up on your Palestinian friends, check up on your Palestine activist friends, help them stay active by helping them stay human